Well, welcome everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Tax Town Hall. Tonight you have two of the four hosts with you. Larry Beecraft, attorney at law from Huntsville, Alabama, and Joe Bannister, former IRS special agent. Sean couldn't be with us tonight, nor could Gary, although Gary may show up in a little while. So let's start with our prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. Well, we certainly need God's blessings, don't we? It was God's blessings that helped found this country and give us all the freedoms that we have. And we appreciate everybody joining us tonight as we tried to learn more about that freedom and defend it. So we are going to start with presentation from Larry, and Larry requested that I unmute Peter. And so Peter is unmuted, and
it looks like he's no longer eating. Am I right, Peter?
If you're going to ask me a question in front of a bunch of people, I'm not going to eat.
He's going to plead the fifth.
There you go.
All right. Well,
so normally we talk about taxes during the course of this program, but we got some current events that are, I look at current events from a legal viewpoint, meaning, you know, there's something behind or a way to interpret current events from a legal viewpoint. And Joe, I hate to say it, let me reach over here. The air conditioner just turned on. It's causing feedback for me. So let me turn it off. One of the things that's really bothering me is this talk that's going on right now about how we're going to engage in, at the federal level, gun control. And, you know, it's starting off like the way it did with Obamacare, you know, 10 years ago. You know, Obamacare came on the scene kind of in a fashion like we're doing right now. You know, there's some talk about it for a little while, and, you know, then it becomes a legislative proposal, and then it becomes law. Well, we're going through the same thing. It's a little bit different now with gun control. But, you know, now we're having certain powers that be behind the scenes are arranging these events that are happening. And these events are causing the public to be concerned about gun control. The left really wanting to control guns, and the right understanding we got a battle on our hands. But I asked this simple question, you know, can we look at both Obamacare and gun control from a legalistic viewpoint that I guarantee you most people are not looking at these events from this particular viewpoint? And here's what I want to get around to in explaining these events so that the people that are on this Zoom meeting with us tonight, they'll walk away with a little bit better understanding of how to interpret current events from a legalistic viewpoint, and then also to use these things that are happening right now. You know, if we want to oppose them in some way or promote them in some way, we now have a new tool that I don't see a whole lot of people using in a battle of this nature. Now, Peter, I want to ask you this question. Is there a difference between dogs and cats?
I would say so.
Okay. Is there a difference between a horse and a cow?
I would say so.
Okay. Now, let's say that dogs, since they're different from cats, they're causing, let's go imagine a little community of, you know, 1,000 people, and they've got maybe 50 dogs and cats in it. And then, you know, they're a little community on an island, and they pass their laws. But the dogs are causing a problem that the cats are not. Now, would you, if you're living in this little island community of 1,000 people and the dogs are posing a problem, but the cats are not, would you pass a law that applied to both dogs and cats?
No.
Okay. And why would that be the case?
because it wouldn't do any good to make a law that applied to the cats if they're not part of the problem.
Oh, good, good. All right. Now, let's say that in this little island community, let's say that there's another problem being created by the men, and the women are not doing this, whatever the problem might be. Would you pass a law that encompassed both men and women?
I would not.
Okay. And if the men are causing the problem, but the women are not, then a law to address the problem that applied to both, rather than just solely men, you know, that would be overbroad. Am I correct?
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. All right. Well, let's say in this island community of 1,000 people, you know, every now and then we get a horde of illegals coming across. And, you know, this invasion by these illegals are a real problem in our society. Now, would you pass a law that encompassed both the people that lived on the island, a part of the people, and to address this problem created by the illegal invasion, would you include in that legislation the native-born citizens?
I would not.
Okay. And the reason for this is that it makes sense just intuitively that people, if you got this great big social problem, you pass a law to address that problem, and you don't include people that are not a part of the problem in the solution. Does that make sense?
Yep.
Okay. Now let's move beyond our little island community of 1,000 people. Let's get over here to the United States of America. Do we have a problem in this country with drunk drivers?
Yeah.
And they get out on the highways drunk and they create accidents, they kill people. Now, let's say that we want to solve the problem created by drunk drivers. And let's say that drunk drivers constitute, 3%. That's a big number. But 3% of the population of the United States. That's a big problem. But it's that 3% that's causing the problem and not the 97%. The 3% drunks on the highway are the problem. Do we pass a law that encompasses everybody, including parties that are not part of the problem?
I would say no.
Okay. Well, there's Sean. He came on.
Yeah, I got here. You know, I just got to tell you, Larry, this dog and cat thing. I was having a small problem with my camera. I've got a cat thing. He's a dog. And once in a while, he gets in here and messes with my equipment. And that's what he did today.
Oh, I see. Oh, so if we wanted to solve that problem in your house, if you passed a law that applied to not only the dog and the cat, but also your wife, that would be overbroad, would it not be?
Well, yeah, I'm pretty sure my wife would object. I think the cat would too, because he's kind of a typical cat. Sometimes he agrees as a cat, sometimes he doesn't.
I see, says the blind man. Okay. I want to get around and make this legal point before we get around into and spend another 10 or 15 minutes on this, because I think it's real important. I think that the people on our side, the patriotic American, you know, we see this stuff coming at us and we need, you know, people to understand the types of legal arguments we can use to oppose them. And what I'm getting ready to talk about, the reason why I went through all these examples of using the island community and the dogs and the cats and the illegals and the illegals, you know, is to deal with this principle known as over-inclusive and under-inclusive classifications. Now, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment applies to the states. Also, at the federal level, there isn't an equal protection clause that applies to the federal government. However, the Supreme Court has said, well, you know, now that we've, you know, outlined and, you know, come up with a real good description of what equal protection is, equal protection is really subsumed. It's a part of due process. So equal protection principles apply to both the state governments and the United States government. Now, I have emailed to you, Joe. Do you see one of those PDF files that have, you know, just some cases in it? I'd like to just kind of pull up the Ah, okay. Now, this is what I'm talking about. The Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment of the United States Constitution provides that no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. Now, there's been a lot of, if you go over to my website, now my website is, you know, I've got two of them. The one that has the legal material on it is the Dixieland Law Journal, and you'll find that by using a search engine. Don't use Google. And type in Beecraft Briefs or Dixieland Law Journal. And when you get over there, there's a page that deals with constitutional and other materials. But I think when you get on the Constitution page, you know, I think I got a file on equal protection, you know, just quotes from cases and links to the cases so you can read them. But, you know, I've just taken a, you know, not that one, Joe. Go back one more. Yeah, see constitutional and other legal materials. And I think, yeah, see down there in the kind of in the middle of the screen, equal protection. Now, if you want more information about equal protection, I've got, you know, summaries of and links to the cases, you can read them. But, you know, this principle that I'm talking about, this, you know, a real good substantial part of equal protection is something that we need to, I want to educate people about, because we got this gun battle coming up in front of us, and we got to use principles of equal protection as an argument against it. But, you know, Joe, go back to that PDF image. Now, here you have on the screen, you know, you have the 14th Amendment provides for the Equal Protection Clause. But then the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment contains an equal protection component, which is similar in effect to the Equal Protection Clause of that clause in the 14th Amendment. And there's a case that deals with that. Now, here's what the down further on the page, Joe, if you can go down, there's two more cases, I believe. Reed versus Reed. You know, this is kind of a quote from the cases. This Reed versus Reed case, Equal Protection Clause denies to the states the power to legislate that different treatment be accorded persons placed by statute into different classes on the basis of criteria wholly unrelated to the objective of the statute. A classification must be reasonable, not arbitrary, and must rest upon some ground of difference having a fair and substantial relation to the object of the legislation. So, you know, you got to take into consideration what is the object of some legislation. And if it makes distinctions, you know, between parties that are encompassed by the legislation and parties that aren't, or, you know, maybe everybody that's a subject of the law is treated a little bit differently. You got subclasses and classes and everything else. There's got to be reasons for, you know, you can't just make a whim to create a difference. Shriners Hospital is a Florida case from 1990. Equal protection analysis requires that classifications be neither too narrow nor too broad to achieve the desired end. Such under-inclusive and over-inclusive classifications fail to meet even the minimal standards of the rational basis test. Now, what I want to bring up for the people that are on this conference call is this. You know, we're looking at Obamacare. You know, I opposed Obamacare when it was came along based on this argument. But, you know, I wrote to my congressman, you know, didn't accomplish anything. But and to me, it's one of the reasons why is because people, this is kind of a sophisticated argument. It's kind of, maybe kind of difficult to understand. But I think once we talk about the examples, you know, the examples will help people understand this concept. Now, with Obamacare, let me ask this, Peter. What was the reason why Obamacare was enacted? Was it because we had uninsured people? People that didn't have insurance, didn't have any medical coverage?
So the story goes.
Yeah. Well, that's what they said. You know, that's what the politicians were saying. Maybe they had some ulterior purpose that wasn't stated. But they clearly stated, oh, we have a problem in this country created by people who are not insured. Was that 100% of the American public? No. That You know, I would dare say that the vast majority of the American public have ways, they have insurance or ways to cover their own medical expenses. So we had a small minority of people that were creating the problem. Now, what did Congress, you know, this is something that's coming down the pike. And, you know, they're using as an excuse, a minority creates a problem. And then once the problem is created, they use that, you know, this is premise, what is the commies, you know, they create a problem.
Yeah, they create a crisis and then they find the problem.
Synthesis and thesis, antithesis, synthesis.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, that's what it is. So they create the problem to drive us in a direction for their preordained solution. And that's the way it was with Obamacare. Now, Obamacare, you know, what they're wanting to use, they're wanting to take over the whole medical industry here in America. And they're using as a reason for doing so, they're saying, oh, we have a minority that is causing a problem. They aren't paying their bills. They don't have medical insurance. But that's not everybody. But the minority, the solution to the problem created by the minority is to take over the entire medical system for everybody? No. You have right there Obamacare, or if they ultimately want to drive down the, you know, further down this road and they want to do like Bernie and AOC and the other wild Democrats are hooping and hollering about, they want to establish a national health care plan for everybody. But the reason that they're doing it, the cause of this is a problem created not by everybody, but by a small minority. Then they're violating equal protection in doing that. They've got to say that the entire public is part of the problem and therefore the whole system has to be taken over means that they have this mindset that is over-inclusive. If you've got a problem created by the uninsured, then pass a law that deals with the uninsured, not to use that as an excuse for taking over the whole system. Now let's get around to guns. And this is what's going on right now. Peter, listen, is this gun problem created by a larger percentage than 5% of the American public?
I would say no.
So it's even less than 5%?
Much less.
Okay, so let's say it might be 2%. 2% of the American people are creating this problem regarding guns. So you pass legislation because we have a problem created by, hey, you know, I can remember maybe it had been 15 years ago, one of the first vile incidences of, you know, this type of activity that's driving them toward, you know, gun control. It happened in a situation here in Huntsville, Alabama, that's not related to gun control directly, but it is a part of the problem. And I can remember there was this kid that killed his parents and attempted to kill his siblings. And this, I can remember this was in something like January or February. They caught this kid who had butchered his parents. And, you know, as they were dragging him to the jail, you know, he was wild-eyed, wild, crazy, didn't have on a shirt, and it was snowing outside. You know, he was just wild and crazy. Ultimately, you know, he was charged. He pled guilty. But then quietly, there was a lawsuit filed by the siblings that survived the assault by their brother against the big drug companies that had filled this kid up with all these drugs. And that's one of the problems that we got this create, you know, the drug problem is causing these lunatics to engage in these gun massacres. I think that that's a big part of the problem. But, you know, that's an aside. We have a real problem here when a minority of the American public is creating problems with guns. Let's buy them. Let's accept their argument. We have a gun problem. I disagree with that, but let's accept that premise. It's created by a small minority. So the solution to this problem is to take away everybody's guns or to infringe any rights of the law abiding. If you do that, then your legislation is over-inclusive and that violates equal protection. Now, does anybody, you know, I hope that this, you know, 20-minute presentation on equal protection has scored some points and people understand it. Is there anybody that doesn't understand it?
I don't, Larry. I have a question.
All right.
So I see the quotes here from the various cases that you put on the screen, but well, when I think of...
I grabbed before we started the program, the chances are they're not really not representative of this. But you can go over to that equal protection file on my website and probably find some cases. You know, I have a list of cases in briefs, you know, where I deal with this over-inclusive and under-inclusive classification. You know, even down here in Shriners Hospital, they're talking about under-inclusive and over-inclusive classifications. So, you know, like in our example here, to impose an obligation on 100% of the gun-owning public or to impose an obligation upon 100% of the public as a result of a problem created by a minority, then the classification that includes all of the public or all of the gun-owning public, that would be overbroad, an over-inclusive classification. Does that make sense?
I understand that it's overly broad, but I don't see the connection to my naive or non-legal understanding of the concept of equal protection of the laws.
Well, you know, all I can say is that when Obamacare really got going strong, you know, and was being promoted, and that was what, 12 years ago, back, you know, 2007, 2008, mm-hmm. You know, that's when it was being promoted. And it popped in my head. Of course, I was raising these issues in reference to battling Social Security numbers. But, you know, I was hoping, and I tried to educate congressmen about this, you know, and it went nowhere. But, you know, I kind of think that what it's going to take, you know, now that we're looking at, you know, something of concern to me, you know, this proposed gun legislation, you know, here we go, and I see it all over again. You can see it with Obamacare. Only a small part of the populace is causing the problem. And yet they use that problem created by a small segment of society to impose obligations on everybody. No, the obligation shouldn't be imposed only on the ones that are causing the problem. Now, the same thing with guns, you know, to sit there and say, oh, well, people who are perfectly law abiding have to have their rights infringed. Because a minority is creating a problem, to include the vast law-abiding gun public in the solution to the problem created by a minority, that is an overbroad classification. And I'm just trying to educate people, since this is going to be the next event that I see where you've got an over-inclusive classification, you know, I want to educate people about this problem.
Well, you know, Larry, looking at the screen we're looking at, and Peter, about 1, 2, 3, 4, fifth case down, Backstrom versus Harold, seems to say it pretty clear. Equal protection does not require that all persons be dealt with identically, but it does require that a distinction made have some relevance to the purpose of which the classification is made. In other words, if you have a problem with people that are, number one, getting illegal guns, number two, people that are mass shooters, for whatever reason they are, they have to be dealt with. Not people that are legally owning, carrying guns, not people that aren't criminals. You're not dealing with those people. You're dealing with people creating the problem.
Right. And that's exactly where the gun grabbers want to go. They want, you know, I've never committed, Joe's never committed. Nobody on this Zoom meeting has created any problem regarding guns. And yet, our gun rights are going to be affected by what, AOC or Bernie or whoever else is going to be promoting some gun legislation. You know, a reason to object is based upon this constitutional objection.
So, Larry,
maybe if we get enough people educated about this and talking to our congressmen saying, You know, now you've got a defense, a complaint that we can make that is couched in legal terms that have significance.
But Larry, let me ask you. So if we're talking about this future gun legislation, and let's take the red flag laws as an example, where they create this legislation enabling, you know, some judge to create this order, not give you any due process. The cops show up, take your guns, and you come to find out that you know, it was some disgruntled relative who didn't like their present at Christmas. And meanwhile, your guns are gone. So are you saying?
Well, you know, no, I wouldn't necessarily say in this situation, in that situation, that this would be an issue. This is an issue for all of us as a group. You know, I would think in that situation, you got a lot more refined, very specific issues in reference to the use of the red flag law. But, you know, they're going to be using red flag. The Congress, but, you know, it's not only red flag. You know, you've got Bernie. You've got Beto O'Rourke. What are you going to take your AR-15 or AK-47? Wow. We're going to take it.
Yeah, he doesn't even understand what he's talking about. First off, I don't believe the guy's ever held a weapon in his hands. But
you're talking more about a gun ban, Larry, or a buyback or some kind of...
Yeah.
The buyback thing. I get a kick out of the buyback thing. The government's going to buy back what? What did they sell to me that they're going to buy back? That's what I want to know. And let's talk about Second Amendment and relevant in relationship to the First Amendment. You want to talk about an amendment that creates violence and terror in the heart of every individual in the country? Let's talk about the First Amendment. You know, if the Second Amendment has to be licensed, why doesn't the First Amendment have to be licensed? I mean, people go out there and create riots. People get killed. People get run over by cars when they're exercising their First Amendment rights. You know, if we're going to have to license a right, why just the Second Amendment? Why don't we start with the First and find out if people are mentally capable of exercising their First Amendment right before we allow them to do it?
Right. True. Or get rid of the Fourth Amendment, and then you don't have to worry about what people keep in their homes because you're going to take it all.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Justice Thomas, I think he has said it many times. He said, you know, the Second Amendment has been relegated to a very low standard in our constitutional protections. And he's kind of wondering why, if we're going to lower what the Second Amendment means, why aren't we doing it to all the amendments? I mean, why does this take precedent over all of the other amendments? If the Second Amendment was so important, why wasn't it the First Amendment? Why was the First Amendment the First Amendment? It doesn't make sense. And, this is the ideology behind these socialists. This doesn't have anything to do with protecting the public. It doesn't have a damn thing to do with protecting the public. It has to do with government control. And as far as government confiscation of weapons, they better start thinking about the realism of what they're talking about. I don't care who you send to your door. When you start sending people to your door, especially armed people with guns, to take away what they have, there's going to be a problem in this country.
Yeah. For sure.
Why would you give up your weapon to somebody that comes to your door with a gun saying, give me your gun or I'm going to have to use mine? By the way, that had something to do with the Second Amendment, why we have it. So realistically speaking, this, you know, if the people think about what these socialists and these Democrats and these liberals are proposing, it's crazy, because if they can take the Second Amendment, they can take it all.
Yep.
It's all gone.
Well, I hope I've educated some people about, you know, a constitutional principle that I think is easy to understand.
I think it's a great argument.
And then once you understand the concept, you know, then these events we see in with this political theater that we're all experiencing, you know, then you're using this legal tool that you have in your mind to interpret events. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, I wanted to oppose Obamacare, of course, the battle's turned a little bit different right now, but you can see the problem with Obamacare. You know, they want to take over the whole, you know, they're using it as an excuse. Oh, some people don't pay their medical bills. Oh, so we got to take over the whole medical system. You know, that's an overbroad response to a limited problem.
Well, not only that, it's creation of a problem that doesn't exist. If the non-payment of medical bills was such a crisis, and it was an endangerment to our society. And I mean, hospitals are businesses, right? They're businesses. If they weren't making money, if they couldn't keep the doors open, they would close. Doctors would shut down. There wouldn't be doctors. This is not a crisis. This is something the government's pointing to, saying, well, gee, some people can't pay their medical bills. Well, I've got some news for people in this country. Think about it. Go into the hospital in an emergency room where you have to have a...
That's the reason why they want medical insurance for the illegals, so that they can pay the bills. The illegals don't have insurance, but they're going to the emergency rooms. The parties that are really behind such legislation are the emergency rooms, the hospitals.
Well, Larry, I propose this. Those bills that the illegal aliens are racking up in the emergency room, they're getting paid. Now, I don't know who's paying them. I don't know how they're paying them. But those hospitals aren't doing this for free.
That's for sure. But they're also passing it on to the other paying customers.
Well, that's true. It's through the insurance company rates and so on and so forth. I don't disagree with that. But again, they're trying to make a crisis out of something that's not a crisis. If it was a crisis, these hospitals would not be in operation. I just don't see how they would stay in operation.
Yeah.
Well, another angle that I've thought, I'm sure I'm not the only one, but the whole Obamacare thing is about finding taxpayers. It's about roping everybody into this insurance system because they know that's going to rope practically everybody. And it's just a way to sniff out more tax money. That's what I thought the main purpose really was.
Well, you know, I got a kick out of the original Obamacare when you took a look and you read at it. They were doing this under the Commerce Clause, which everybody from the get-go, I think, didn't believe for 1 minute the Commerce Clause was going to be expanded to that degree. Fortunately, Thomas has had prevailed there. So they said, well, it's a tax. What was crazy about that? Robert sits there and says, well, you know, they can do this under the taxing power. Though, you know, we're going to admit that it's really not a tax because government says it's a penalty if you don't buy it, but it's kind of under the taxing power. So even though it's not a tax, it's a penalty. We're going to call the penalty a tax, and therefore it's good under the taxing power. Now here's the crazy part about it. Now it's not enforceable. Their penalty was unenforceable. How are they going to enforce it? Well, they give it to the IRS to enforce it. That's what they did. And then you had to claim it on your income tax return, and then they were going to bill you accordingly or raise your taxes accordingly if you didn't show medical insurance. Thing is that they couldn't collect on that penalty by virtue of a lien or a levy. They were prohibited from doing that. They simply couldn't do it. So it was kind of crazy to begin with, but I'll tell you what, they had the people hoodwinked on this whole thing. And the way they were going to collect their penalty on the original Obamacare as well, if you had a tax refund, we were just going to withhold the tax refund because we can't lien or levy against you for it. Well, there's a couple ways to cure that. That's through withholding, which is Larry's favorite subject, and mine too. You cure that through withholding. You don't have excess withholding, if you have any at all. And second, if you really don't want the government to know about what you carry for medical care or not, simply don't file a tax return. I mean, the purpose of the tax return is collect taxes, right? Why would you have to declare anything about your medical life on your tax return? Why would that be there unless there was another purpose, another reason? Social engineering, absolutely.
Hey, I've got something else I wanted to cover. You know, I don't want to monopolize all this, but I had another point that relates exactly to what we're talking about. So, Joe, pull up that treaty document. Oh, no. Well, minimize that. It's the one on my website.
Okay.
That one we'll come to after I go through all this. You know, Peter, where in the world in Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution does it say that Congress can create a Social Security retirement program even? Is it there?
I'm sure it's not.
Okay, Joe, it was the go back to federal jurisdiction, go down to federal jurisdiction and pull up treaties down there at the bottom. Boom. Now let's go down about halfway through, and then we're going to have to find it. And after we find it, I've got to
put it in context. Ah, okay, right, right. Okay, Alton Railway. Okay, now we're there. Yeah. You know, Article 1, Section 8 of the United States Constitution sets forth the powers of Congress. It does not include any authority, as if they had even passed through the minds of our founding fathers, that there was even a retirement program. They didn't have retirements back in the late 18th century. It was, you know, it's only in the 20th century do you get around to this concept that people need to retire at a certain age. You know, what you did back, so the retirement wasn't even in anybody's mind. It was not something that was known to exist by our founding fathers. So there is nothing in the United States Constitution that deals with the authority to establish any type of retirement program or medical program at the federal level. Well, here's what happened. How does this come about? And a lot of people aren't aware of these limitations. In the late 20s and the early 30s, at the international level, and when I say the international level, you know, I'm talking about, you know, there is a community at the international level that is left wing. But back in the early 30s, you know, they were interested in banning warfare. I'll agree with that. But also at the federal level, I mean, at the international level, there was an interest, you know, in what was being promoted by the communists. You know, they wanted retirement programs. They wanted medical care. So here at the federal level, and there was also something going on in reference to guns, but that's beyond our program tonight. You know, there was things going on at the international level, also in relationship to firearms and guns. It has kind of a related track to what I'm talking about here. But the